cults, hidden killers investigates. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The first time he used an ATM was the day he left the 12 tribes. The first time he used a vending machine, he was an adult with an adult body and adult responsibilities, but he had the life skills of a child who had never been allowed to interact with the world. One former member described the experience of leaving as being born suddenly with an adult body, feeling like a child or an alien, but needing to act like an adult to survive. He'd been raised inside the group from birth. He knew nothing about how anything worked outside the compound walls. Everything was strange. Everything was new. And nobody had prepared him for any of it. Because the whole point was that he was never supposed to leave. This is part four of Behind the Yellow Deli. We've walked through the front door, into the rooms where former members say children were struck, and through the life of the man who built this system. This episode is about the people who got out and what was waiting for them on the other side, which, according to the people who lived it, was nothing. Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube as we work our way through it. Press subscribe while you're at it so you don't miss any of it. Nothing on the outside. That's the part of the 12 Tribes story that does not make the documentary trailers. The raid footage is dramatic. The hidden camera video from Germany is damaging. The allegations of abuse generate headlines. But the thing that should keep you thinking long after the headline fades is what happens to the people who get out. Because getting out is not the end of the story. For many, it's the beginning of a second ordeal that is quieter, lonelier, and in some ways harder than the first. Leaving the 12 tribes is not like quitting a church. It's not like moving away from a hometown you've outgrown. Former members describe a world that was allegedly designed deliberately and systematically to make departure feel impossible. Members reportedly have no money. Their savings were surrendered upon joining. They have no resume. Their labor is unpaid and unrecorded. You're not going to get a reference from them. Many have no education beyond the group's own homeschooling, which focused on religious instruction and manual skills rather than anything the outside world recognizes. Again, all designed to keep you there. They have no outside social network. Contact with non-members, including their own parents and siblings, was allegedly restricted or forbidden. This can't be the place I get those sandwiches from. Oh, it is. According to former members, you were taught that the outside world is evil, that leaving the community means spiritual death, that your children will be lost without the group's guidance. For people who were born into the 12 tribes, second and third generation members who have never known anything else, there is nothing to go back to. There is only forward. Into a world they were raised to fear. Consider what that means practically. You walk out the door at 12 tribes of the compound and you got nothing. No bank account, no driver's license, in some cases no credit history, no work history that any employer would really recognize, no understanding of how to rent an apartment, apply for a job, file a tax return, or navigate a grocery store without someone telling you what to buy. You may not know your birth name. You may not have your social security card. You may not have any identification at all. And the community you just left, the only community you've ever known, reportedly considers you dead. Former members describe the severance as total. One man whose parents are still inside the 12 tribes said they consider him dead. It's not a metaphor. That's how he described their position. Showa Jones left the 12 tribes at 15 years old. She'd been raised inside the group her entire life. Her parents and oldest brother remained. Eventually, four of her five siblings also left one by one over years. Showa graduated magna cum laude at the University of South Florida. She married. She had children. She got a lotus flower tattoo on her shoulder, a symbol of rebirth. She built a life, but the building happened from a foundation of nothing because the 12 tribes had allegedly provided no preparation for life outside and every incentive to stay. Every tool she needed to succeed in the world, from basic financial literacy to the ability to make independent decisions without fear of spiritual punishment, had to be learned from scratch. It's coercive control. She was not incapable. She was never incapable. The system reportedly made her dependent by design, not by nature. The distinction matters because it tells you that the lack of preparation is not an accident or an oversight. It is, according to former members, a feature. Her story is a success story. Not every story is. A man named Matthias was born into the 12 tribes and spent years inside before leaving. He described the experience of entering the outside world as knowing nothing. The first ATM, the first vending machine, the first independent decision without a group authority telling him whether it was permitted. He did not know how the world worked because the world was the thing the group was designed to keep out. Another former member, a man who spent 20 years inside, left in 2016, spoke to reporters on the condition of anonymity because his family is still in the group. He described the discipline, the control, the total erasure of individual autonomy. And then he described something more complicated, the fact that the group is not all darkness. There are nice people inside. There is genuine community. There is warmth. That's why people stay. It's also why leaving is so disorienting. Because you're not just leaving an abuser. You're leaving a community that, in many ways, was the only family you ever had. It's how abusers keep people in their fold. It is. It's just on a group level. Tamara Mathayo spent 14 years in the 12 tribes. She was lured in at a vulnerable moment in her life, the kind of moment the recruitment pipeline is allegedly designed to identify and exploit. She described what started as a promise of stability and community turning into an authoritarian nightmare, especially for women and children. She has since written a memoir called All Who Believed, a raw account of survival and escape. For Tamara, getting out was not one decision. It was hundreds of small decisions made against the weight of everything the group had taught her about what leaving would mean. Matthew Klein is another former member. He was an industrial chemist who joined the 12 tribes in 1999, drawn by what he described as a genuine desire to be a good Christian. He sold his house and his business, emptied his bank account, and surrendered everything to the community. Once inside, he described working 20-hour days for no pay. He described the child discipline. He described the reality beneath the surface that the group's websites and public-facing materials are designed to obscure. And then he left. And he had to start over from scratch. A professional with a chemistry background who had voluntarily liquidated his entire life. Each of these stories is different in its details, but they are identical in their architecture. The warmth, the walls, the fear, and then the fracture point. The moment when staying becomes more terrifying than the unknown, and the person walks out the door into a world that has no infrastructure waiting for them on the other side. And that brings us to the detail that haunts the entire series. Cult researchers and investigators have studied groups like the 12 tribes. They have a documented pattern that complicates every success story. A significant number of people who leave high-control groups go on to join other closed societies, other communal movements, other authoritarian structures. The phenomenon has been observed across dozens of organizations. One investigator who worked a different cult case in Utah, a group with similar structure of communal control and child abuse, described being haunted by the fact that after his team broke up the group and rescued children, many of the freed members drifted into other polygamous groups, doomsday cults, and fringe communities. The exit was not an exit. For people whose entire identity has been shaped by total submission, whose sense of self has been deliberately dismantled and rebuilt around obedience and authority, freedom was not freedom. It was a vacuum. And many of them filled it with the only thing they knew, another authority to submit to. Cult psychology researchers, including Stephen Hassan, have described this pattern as one of the most challenging aspects of recovery from coercive groups. The 12 tribes, with its emphasis on total surrender of identity, property, autonomy, reportedly creates exactly the conditions that make this pattern most likely. That pattern is not unique to the 12 tribes. Cult researchers have documented it across dozens of organizations, but it is a pattern that should force us to ask harder questions about what recovery actually looks like, because there's no formal exit support infrastructure for people leaving the 12 tribes. There is no government funded deprogramming. There is no network of halfway houses for cult survivors. There are individual therapists and researchers and advocates who do this work, often for very little compensation, because the systems that should be providing the support do not exist. A person can walk out of the 12 tribes compound and find themselves standing on a sidewalk in a small American town with no money, no identification, no social skills, no understanding of how to function independently, and no one waiting for them. Some of them find their way, some of them do not. And some of them walk right into the next open door because the lesson the 12 tribes reportedly taught them, that they cannot survive without a community telling them what to do, turns out to be the hardest lesson to unlearn. The practical challenges alone are staggering. Even before you consider the psychological ones, former members describe learning to cook for themselves for the first time, not because they could not cook, but because they had never made a decision about what to eat without group authority. They describe the paralysis of walking into a store with hundreds of options when their entire lives have been structured around having no options at all. They describe the loneliness of sitting in an apartment alone for the first time after spending decades in communal housing, where someone was always present, always watching, always involved in every aspect of your day. The silence, some say, was the hardest part. Not because they missed the noise, but because the silence forced them to confront the fact that they did not know who they were outside the group. Their identity had been assigned. Their name had been assigned. Their purpose had been assigned. And when all of that was stripped away, what remained was a person who had to figure out from scratch what they believed, what they wanted, and who they actually were. That's the abuse. That coercive control communities, cults, extreme fundamentalist religious organizations do to its victims. Or as they call their followers, their members. You know, words that imply that they're there willingly. Like they actually have a choice to be part of the group. Bob Pardon, co-founder of the New England Institute of Religious Research, has spent years working with former 12 Tribes members and studying the group's internal dynamics. He has described the organization as having a very seedy underbelly beneath the public-facing message of love and community. But he's also described the difficulty of helping people who have been so thoroughly conditioned that their sense of self is inseparable from the group. The 12 Tribes does not just control behavior, it reportedly rewrites identity. Members take new names, they lose access to their personal histories, they are taught that everything they were before they joined was fallen, broken, worthless. Let that go. When they leave, they're not just rebuilding a life, they're rebuilding a self. That's the cost of getting out. Not just poverty or isolation or fear, a fundamental rupture in a sense of who you are. And the 12 Tribes, according to former members, builds that rupture into the design. The lack of outside skills is not an accident. The lack of outside relationships is not an accident. The erasure of personal identity is not an accident. All of it is reportedly serving the same function, making departure so painful, so disorienting that staying even a system, staying in a system that does horrible things to your children and takes your money and controls your every waking hour feels safer than the alternative. The question I want to leave you here is not whether people can escape the 12 tribes. They can. They have. They're doing it. The question is what it costs them. and what it says about the depths of control when the hardest part is not getting out, but surviving after you do. And what it says about the rest of us, that there's no system waiting to catch them when they land. In the final part of Behind the Yellow Deli, we ask the question that this entire series has been building towards. The evidence spans 50 years and three continents. Former members have spoken, courts have ruled, the FBI has documented, and the Yellow Deli is still open. Why has nobody stopped them? That's coming up next. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love to hear them, especially if you're a former member and have gotten out. From this group or any. Because you probably realizing this, if you study cults or have been a part of one, they're all alike. They all have the same tenets and principles to keep people controlled. These have different names. And some sell sandwiches that might be quite delicious. But are you willing to sell your soul for a salami on rye? We'll continue our conversation in the comments section. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any part of our series. Like I said, this is part four. There's three other parts ahead of it. Go back and check them out if you've not done that yet. Part five is up next. We'll continue our conversation there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.